Professor Bach, Labor Law, December 1st, 2008, podcast number 6, room number 230.
Yes. I didn't ask for it. So, to the extent that somebody did, wasn't it? Don't tell me you attacked him in the hall. I knew it.
I'm going to have to, unfortunately, I'm going to have to leave class a little early today because my artwork is going to be showing in an exhibit. So I have to show up.
Evidently, they have arranged for this podcast.
Oh, really?
To me, so.
Yeah.
The first hour is the last hour of substantive material. After that, there'll just be a review session for the sample. You won't be missing anything substantive if you say for the first hour.
No, I won't be leaving until 8.
Okay.
Also, I was wondering if I could just make a quick announcement. I appreciate you. Well, this
is the last class, and you're making an announcement. What is this?
There's, I believe, charges. Yeah, unfair labor practices charges have been filed with the NLRB in this case. The employer has done some pretty messed up things to stop these workers from forming a union.
I ordinarily would be willing to let you get an education, but I can't let you do this. I don't know why.
What's that?
But as you say, there are charges that have been filed. Yeah. My class could be construed as a venue for your union activity.
Uh-huh.
Even if it's not your union activity, it could be interpreted that way, and it risks our ability to be impartial in investigating a charge, which, quite frankly, from the advocate's perspective,
I'm not actually familiar with all the details.
You should be careful, because it could compromise our region's ability to do the case.
Got it.
So,
got it.
While you can hand this out to anybody you'd like, and I'm not going to enforce hospice private property laws on you.
No, I understand.
But understand, that's the reason. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a problem with it.
Got
but
it.
That could be trouble.
Got it.
And I don't want to put the region in the position of being, even if it wasn't true, being perceived to be showing some sort of favoritism toward the charged party when we're not.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Anyone on the podcast listening is true. I know I'm being recorded, but that's not why I'm saying it. Well, here, don't leave. Here's your artwork. I'm sorry? No. I don't care. In view of the various and sundry conditions in which I've worked, whether the window is open or not, is of no moment to me. You want it open, keep it open. You want it closed, keep it closed. I take no position. You don't want to Perhaps that would show your true mettle, your ability to navigate through a series of difficult law exams while you're sick. Okay. We have about an hour more of substantive material, probably a little bit less. After I'm done with that, I'll make some closing remarks, and we'll take a break and come back. You don't have to at that point, but after that, if you want to come back after the break, we'll do a review session. We'll go through the sample question that I handed out and emailed to some who were not here. And after we're concluded with that, anybody who missed the last class and was forced to listen to it on the podcast probably noticed there's a gap. I listened to the podcast, and I believe I determined what the gap is. So feel free to stick around after the conclusion of the review session, and I'll go through what you missed and what was discussed on the portion of the podcast that wasn't cast for part of that. And oh, by the way, as an inducement, anybody who wants, I brought cookies. But not for now, because you would be high on sugar, you know, and not be understanding the significant and important concepts I'm about to discuss and explain. So I thought it probably was the most best thing to leave the cookies for the review session. Did you ever see an 8-year-old or a 3-year-old on sugar? You would all be exhausted in about 15 minutes. More students or not, wouldn't make a difference. You'd all be flat out. Exhausted. Okay. Where we left off was with a discussion of subcontracting. We talked about that as the last sort of topic against the backdrop of a discussion of mandatory subjects of bargaining and permissive subjects of bargaining. You recall that mandatory subjects are those about which the employer and the union are obligated to bargain. Permissive subjects are those that the parties can bargain about if they want, but they're not required to bargain about. And you also remember that the way this ordinarily comes up in the permissive context is when either party conditions reaching a full agreement on a permissive subject. We talked about what some of the permissive subjects were. I don't want to go into that all over again, but the theory being that if a party is insisting to impasse or conditioning a full agreement or reaching a full agreement on a permissive subject, that party is essentially avoiding the obligation to discuss mandatory subjects. Thus, the violation of the duty to bargain in good faith for the employer, Section 8A5, and for the union, Section 8B3. We also talked about unilateral changes and the impasse rule. If you recall, what we said was that in certain circumstances, if the parties are engaged in negotiations, the employer is not permitted to unilaterally do anything, to make unilateral changes to terms and conditions of employment without having reached a good faith impasse. Whether or not parties are in an impasse is entirely based on the facts of any given case, dictated by a number of criteria. The length of negotiations, what's being said in the negotiations, whether any agreement has been reached at all. And impasse can loosely really be defined as we've exhausted any prospect of reaching an agreement, and I, as the employer, need to be able to operate here. Thus, this is not so much an economic weapon as it is a need to survive and to continue my business. I've tried, I've bargained in good faith, but it's not working, okay? If I reach a good faith impasse with you, I can now implement the last offer that I made. It is, of course, we talked about last time, a breach of the duty to bargain in good faith for the employer to implement a proposal other than the last one it proposed. In other words, it can't deviate from that last proposal. Do you have a question?
No, you answered it.
Okay. But you remember I talked about the impasse rule as being applicable to the situation where negotiations are in progress. When negotiations are not in progress, the employer has given notice to the union and an opportunity to bargain over the proposed change, and the union does nothing. The union may be waiving its rights to bargain over something that it might have had a right to bargain about.
Yeah. Let's say, does that include topics that they didn't bargain about when they were bargaining?
That's exactly where I'm going, okay? Because I know it sounds a little confusing against the backdrop of negotiations in progress or not in progress. Where are we in this factual setting? And that the point that you raised is exactly where we're about to get. You've got two different factual scenarios. One is where a collective bargaining agreement is in effect, and the other where there's no collective bargaining agreement in effect. So let's sort of identify these rules. Okay. Let's start with a contract in effect. And by the way, this is all for mandatory subjects. Okay? Assume that we're talking about a mandatory subject to bargain. Wages, hours, a safety provision, pension, health care. The things that ordinarily come up. Okay? If you've got a contract in effect, okay, rule number one is that the employer is not permitted to modify a contractual term without consent, okay? What am I talking about? Okay, we have a collective bargaining agreement in effect. There is a wage provision for production and maintenance employees in the unit at $17 an hour. Okay? The employer decides, I'm tired of this. I don't like paying $17 an hour. I want to pay $14 an hour. Okay? The employer goes and does it. Regardless of whether the employer reached an impasse, gave notice and an opportunity to the union to bargain about this, that doesn't enter the equation. Okay? We don't care. The employer cannot modify that contractual term without consent. So let's say the employer says, I want to pay $14, but I know there's a union here. I better let her know. Call the union. I want to change to $14. They leave a message. They don't get a response. Right? They give 3 weeks. They write a letter. I want to change to $14. Nothing. They say, well, gee, I think the union doesn't care. They go and do it. Whoa! All of a sudden, the union hits the roof and has a canary and files an unfair labor practice charge. Writes a letter, right? The employer says, look at me. I gave you a chance. I gave you notice and opportunity. Doesn't matter. That's not enough. Okay? They needed the union's consent because the term was contained in the contract. Okay? Easy. Rule number one. Rule number two. What if the contract... let's see. The collective bargaining agreement, let's say it covers a term... contract covers a specific term. The same as the hypothetical number one. But in this situation, okay, now the employer says to the union, look, I want to change the wage rate in the contract from 17 to 14. Maybe the union is sympathetic, okay? Maybe the union realizes that this employer needs to change this term and it's having a problem. The union can certainly sit down and start negotiating in the middle of the contract with the employer over this. And if the parties want to, they could reach an agreement modifying their contract, okay, lowering the wage rate. There's nothing wrong with that. However, if the contract covers the term, even if the union in my hypothetical, sit down with the employer and start the bargain. They never had the obligation to do that. Okay? They don't have to do that. Remember, they need to give consent. Right? But if they start to bargain, they could, but nothing's compelling them to. So let's say they're in the middle of bargaining. And they decide, you know what, this employer is not paying. They want 14, I offered 16, they came back with 14, 50. I don't feel like doing this as a union. I'm tired of this, it's a waste of time. You know what, I'm going to tell the employer, forget it, I changed my mind. Is that okay, is that not okay? Answer, perfectly fine. The union can walk away from those negotiations anytime they want. Regardless of whether an impasse is reached, is not reached, doesn't matter. Okay? So a contract covers specific terms. Bargaining okay. Not required. Everybody follow this? See why? They didn't have to do it in the first place, okay? I can't tell you the number of cases we get. It happens all the time. Where whichever party, mine is the union, coming back to the table at the employer's request, more often than not, it's the employer coming back to the table at the union's request over something. But it doesn't matter. The rule is the same either way. The parties sit down and they start the bargain, and the party that doesn't have the obligations grows really tired of it really fast and says, the heck with this. You know what? I don't want to do this with you anymore. I'm leaving. And the other side says, whoa, wait a minute. You have to. You're breaching the duty to bargain in good faith. No, they're not. They didn't have to be there in the first place. Okay? The more complicated comes with number three. Okay? That's where you have, in these two scenarios, you had a term that was contained in the contract. Right? In both situations, and the issue was, number one, the employer can't modify it. Number two, both parties could bargain over that they want, they don't have to. Yeah.
But if the terms of the collective bargaining agreement were off, like on that system?
That's different. If the contract has expired, then that's no contract in effect. I'm not up to that yet. Hold your horses. We'll get there. All right. What about a situation where the contract does not cover the term? Okay? For instance, the parties have a full collective bargaining agreement in effect. They're mid-contract, right? The union decides, you know, there's nothing about safety in this contract. And I've gotten three calls in the last week from employees complaining that the place is unsafe. Let's bargain a safety provision with the employer, right? For mandatory subjects of bargaining like safety, wages, hours, terms and conditions of employment, the obligation to bargain, the duty of good faith bargaining, requires the employer to bargain over subjects even during the contract that are not covered by the contract and did not arise during negotiations for the contract. Now that's tricky. Give you some. Not discussed. And what I mean is the term is not discussed during negotiations that led to this contract. So, what gets tricky here is we were negotiating this contract that's now in effect, okay, union and employer, and in so doing, we talked about safety, right? We passed upon it. The union wanted a safety provision. The employer didn't want it. The employer decided to table it. Said, forget it. Let's talk about it later. We never got it in the agreement. What's going to come up is whether or not there was an agreement not to have it in there. Because if the parties agreed not to have it in there, the employer doesn't have to bargain over it during the term of the contract. Okay? That's a complicated and sticky area. Sometimes it comes up, you know, and it puts the NLRB in the position of having to decipher what happened during the bargaining for the contract. Because if we come to the conclusion at the NLRB that this term was discussed and the parties agreed that it wouldn't be in there, then the employer is entitled to the benefit of its bargain for the full term of the contract that it not be in there. On the other hand, if it was never discussed, okay, it never came up during negotiations for this agreement, the bargaining obligation the employer has and the union has is to bargain about it during the term of the contract because it was never discussed. That's important. It comes up a lot. Last but not least, I know it's at the bottom, but it's something the lawyer gave you last week. It's basically where you've got a contract in effect, right? And a situation where negotiations are not in progress, okay? you know from number one, the employer can't modify this. But if they do decide to talk, okay, and the union wakes up, well, it's probably easier to leave it with these three. See, what I'm trying to get at is understand the context of negotiations in progress, both with a contract in effect and a contract not in effect. Okay? Sometimes you're going to have a situation where there's a contract in effect, but no negotiations are in progress, yet you have to decipher whether or not you fall into rule number one, or you're in a situation where there's a notice and opportunity issue. And this gets confusing, and it's tough to explain, but if there's a contract in effect and no negotiations are in progress, a la up here, okay? Let's say that the union doesn't ignore the notice and opportunity, starts to bargain, okay? Gets into the negotiations, right? Now, if negotiations are in progress, the question becomes, does the impasse rule apply? Remember this. Always default to the situation in numbers one and two, okay? Where we are, as the union, not obligated to discuss something if there's a contractual term covered. We can if we want, but we don't have to. And we can stop anytime we want. That's probably the best way to do it, because it gets too confusing the other way. You see, you could view it one of two ways. Let's say that the employer starts bargaining with the union, and the union agrees to bargain, a la, you know, number two, it's okay to do but not required. And finally, the employer says, you know, I've had enough. I'm just going to do this. In essence, you're going to default, I think, into number one. There's a contractual term covering. You cannot modify that contract. An impasse won't save you. Okay? The impasse situation really doesn't come into play. When you have a contract in effect, the rules tend to be easier. This issue doesn't really come up. Nor does this, of course, since there'll be no term to modify because there's no contract in effect. Yeah.
What if you're in the third situation where the contract is not covered the term, and so the employer makes a proposal to bargain about the mandatory subject, the subject is not covered in the contract. There's a contract. The union accepts the proposal, they start to negotiate, and then they reach a good bid process.
Yeah, sir. Say that again. In other words, what?
So the first hypothetical you gave,
yeah,
is where, so the employer makes a proposal to bargain about, let's say, the subject is break time.
Okay. Is it covered by the contract?
And it's not covered by the contract, but there is a contract in effect.
Okay.
The union says, okay, we should have the written clause about this.
Right.
They start to negotiate. And then they can't agree. They reach a good faith impasse.
Once having reached a good faith impasse, I think at that point the employer can do it. In other words, it kind of goes to number four, which I was trying to punt on. It's complicated. But basically what you get is where the parties have this bargaining obligation, okay? Number three, the contract doesn't cover the term. Now, employer and union know, we got to negotiate over this. If they reach an impasse, the employer can do it.
And Adam did the question, throw it in. So, impasse, if negotiations take place in three. I don't know if anybody can read that. But
see, three, the obligation to bargain continues. So if the obligation to bargain continues and now we're going to do it, can I reach an impasse?
Yes.
And then the employer can.
Mm-hmm.
The terms that are not included in the contract that they want to talk about in number three,
yeah.
Those have to be mandatory.
Yes. Yes. This always comes up in the backdrop of mandatory subjects. Always. Exactly. So what if you have a contract? What if you don't have a contract in effect? Well, you already know. Number one, it's easy. Bargaining is over mandatory subjects. That you remember from last week, right? Number two, right? Your typical situation where the parties don't have a contract and they're going to be bargaining for one, that's negotiations are in progress. So if the employer is going to unilaterally implement anything, she's got to reach a good faith impasse. I keep writing impasse, it really is. Good faith. Because if there's no good faith, or the employer is engaged in bad faith, she can't reach an impasse and implement. That's not the kind of impasse you're allowed to reach them. Three is a more unusual situation. We have no contract in effect, and negotiations are not in progress. That's the notice and opportunity. So if negotiations are not in progress, we don't have a contract in effect, and the employer pats the union on the shoulder and says, you know, I'm planning to implement a wage increase here, $1.50 an hour. And the union is silent. And the employer does it. The employer has met its obligation, regardless of the fact that she didn't reach a good faith impasse. Yeah?
This goes for both ways. If the union wants to change something.
Yes. Although, frankly, it never comes up in the context of the union wanting to change something, because what power does the union really have to change the terms and conditions of employment?
It's on a hypo where it
would be. Yeah, it runs both ways, sure. Yeah.
What kind of notice requirements? Is it a certified mail or a phone call or something the shop's doing?
Oh. That's interesting. Probably the safest bet for the employer is a letter that's mailed both regular and certified. Telling the shop steward that it might get you there, but no employer would want to really rely on that. That's kind of flimsy, you know? Yeah.
How long does the employer have to wait until he decides to act? Like a couple of weeks, a couple
of
days?
Oh, pretty quick, I would think. In other words, employer writes the letter on December 1st, right? Waits to hear. Employer waits 2 weeks to hear back. Here's nothing. Week number three, implements. I think that's reasonable. The employer gives notice on December 1st, and then in April of next year does it. I think the employer has to give new notice. It's a little, you know? But you're kind of in... I don't think there's any hard and fast rule on that. Yeah.
So as long as the bargaining is in notice and there's a response and the bargaining is done to a good faith, you should invest in it.
Yeah.
No contract.
Well,
basically, yeah. Not
plenty. But you have to remember, reaching a good faith impasse is not as easy as you might think. A skilled union knows how to avoid an employer reaching impasse. Sure. The impasse and whether you've reached one is dictated by a series of five factors that are explained in a case called Taft Broadcasting, which I didn't assign to you. But I don't ask me to recite the Taft Broadcasting factors off the top of my head. But I think it's fair to say that the length of negotiations is going to be key. What was discussed in these negotiations is going to be important. The nature of the relationship between the two parties, the history of collective bargaining between the parties is going to be significant. I remember those right off the top of my head, and there are several others. There are a couple of others that come into play. Very often, the length of negotiations, how long the negotiation sessions are taking place, plays a big part, you know, here. We also look at, you know, conduct both at the bargaining table and away from it. I mean, more often than not, it's not so much whether an impasse is reached, but whether it's reached against the backdrop of good faith. You get an employer committing unfair labor practices, making threatening or coercive statements away from the bargaining table. To the extent that spreads throughout the bargaining unit and employees hear about it, the employer really can't argue that it's reached a good faith impasse in negotiations, since she's engaging in bad faith elsewhere. So there are a lot of permutations that come up, but it is. It's a totality of the circumstances. It's based entirely on the fact that impasse is pretty tough to prove for an employer. You have to really be at your wit's end in order to be at an impasse. Yeah?
So, could you explain the third one a little bit more? Mm-hmm. So, if you're saying that the union has notice of the proposal to bargain,
right,
an opportunity to bargain, and they do nothing?
It's a waiver.
They have waived their right to bargain.
Even over a mandatory subject, yes. In these circumstances, what you have to remember is, don't get confused between number three over here and number one over here. Okay? In other words, okay, I don't have a contract in effect, I'm the union, right? The employer writes me a letter. I'm planning on giving employees a wage increase of $1.50 an hour. I'd like to do this. I'm inviting you to negotiate over this if you want to. The parties are not negotiating a contract for some reason at this point. Maybe they're not ready to. Maybe they don't want to. Maybe there's a cooling off period for some reason. It does happen, right? If the union is silent and says nothing, and the employer does it, the union cannot later say, wait a minute, how come I didn't get a right to bargain over this? Well, they gave you a chance to bargain over it, and you didn't say anything, right? That's different from where negotiations are in progress, because where negotiations are actually in progress, well, they're sitting there talking to one another. So it's hard to argue that the union is only entitled to notice and an opportunity. They're sitting there talking to one another already. This notice and opportunity standard is reserved for those situations where the parties are not really talking. Yeah?
Is there ever a case where the response is not considered a yes response or an adequate response?
Yes. That comes up occasionally where the union responds by saying something like, we're in receipt of your notice. We'll be back to you in short order regarding a more substantive response. And they say nothing. You know, that would weigh against the union. They're playing a game, okay? They don't say anything, yeah.
And if the union unilaterally acted in either of these 85 violations?
Well, yeah. Well, the employer unilaterally acted. Yes, it is. You see, what's important to remember here is that because you have no contract in effect, and negotiations are in progress, the union has nothing to rest on. As opposed to here, number one, if they're silent, they've already got the term in their contract. Their silence would be understandable almost. You could see the wheels turning in the union's head. The employer has written a letter saying, dear union, I want to raise wages $1 an hour, right? The union says, well, a contract in effect that calls for $1.50 in 6 months. So, what am I? I don't have to respond to that. There's nothing compelling me to respond to that as the union because I have the term of my contract in effect right now, okay? I know that this employer cannot modify that contract without me saying it's okay. So just to tell me it's planning on doing this, here, the burden is on the employer to get me to affirmatively respond and say it's okay. It's not enough to just say I'm going to do it. Why? There's a contractual term in effect. Here, there is no contractual term in effect. There's nothing. That's where the settings are different, and that's why the rules are different. Got it? Yeah?
Number gone from the no contract and that conversion to what? Mandatory subjects?
Yes. Both of these situations refer to mandatory subjects.
But just, I realize that's 2 and 3 regarding when negotiations are in progress, not in progress. Number 1 refers to
mandatory subjects.
I guess I'm asking, I realize that they have that good faith impasse and change in 2, and notice actually 3, but 1 is.
Well, 1, we have a term already in effect.
Under no contract?
Okay. This just sets forth that this is all dealing with the obligation to bargain over mandatory subjects. Okay? That's all. In other words, that's true of all of this. I mean, I think I kind of wanted to bring that home a little bit more against the backdrop of 2 and 3. You know, this is all going to be mandatory subjects. In other words, we have a permissive subject. I don't have a, neither side has an obligation to bargain over that at all. Okay? If the, you know, the union raises some permissive subject and wants the employer to bargain about it, the employer can say, no, I don't want to get into that. I gave an example, I think, last week where having a court reporter record negotiations is a permissive subject. That comes up a lot, quite a bit, where one side, before they've ever started to bargain, says, okay, we're going to get ready to bargain the contract, but I want the tape recorder turned on. And the other side says, wait, hold everything. I don't want the tape recorder here. That's going to inhibit negotiations, inhibit my ability to speak freely. I don't want it. And the other side says, well, I'm not bargaining with you unless we have it. Boom, right there, problem. For the party that insisted, right? You can't just insist on it. Because you're trying to avoid the real subjects. And what that wasn't always the law. Tape recording negotiations was a real point of contention back in the, I guess it was the early 80s, late 70s. And they finally came out with a case holding that it was permissible. Yeah.
Is it permissive
subject? If the employer can unilaterally implement that then?
Say again? If the permissive subject, what happens if the employer wants to unilaterally implement that subject?
Interesting question. I don't think you can. I think you can put it on the table, you know, and say, hey, I'd like to do this, but once the other side says no, that's it. I don't think the employer can just do it. Yeah.
I'm not sure if I misheard you, or just if I'm confused in general, but did you say just now that the person who's insisting on the tape recorder would be the one with the problem, not the person who's...
Yes. In other words, the party that is conditioning further negotiations on the presence of the tape recorder is the party insisting to impasse on the permissive subject. In other words, the tape recording of negotiations is the permissive subject, okay? Therefore, the party that is insisting that a tape recorder be turned on, that party is the one that's engaging in the violation.
So the person who's out of luck is the person saying, I won't do anything unless I get what I want, not the person who says, but I don't
right.
want to do.
Right. The person who says on a permissive subject, no way. That person has every right to say no way. That party can say, look, it's nice if you want to do that. I don't want that. At that point, the conversation then ends. The other side has to back off. The other side can't implement. He can't say, well, what if? He can't say, look, I don't want to talk to you unless I get my way. Right then and there, the refusal is the end of the game. Yeah?
So what is the board do in that situation then, where they've reached an impasse over a permissive subject? So what is the board going to order?
Ah, the party that has insisted on the permissive subject and is refusing to negotiate without it will get a complaint filed against it. The case litigated or settlement, the order would be stop doing that. Okay? Cease and desist from insisting to impasse on recording bargaining negotiations. Back off. Which compels that party to now say, okay, let's talk about wages and all that other stuff that we're supposed to be talking about. It's a little tricky. Even I got tripped up on getting to number 4. But they're important because when you take a step back, put it away tonight and look at it again tomorrow, they actually make a lot of sense, okay? And they work well, and they lead you to the correct conclusion, I think. Does Eric Friedman still teach constitutional law here? Well, I had him for constitutional law, and he had a series of rules. I think it was, I can't remember whether it was Commerce Clause or it was one of those things you study in the first part of constitutional law. I forget what it was, where it always got you out to the right answer. This is kind of like that, you know? You'll always get to the right place if you simply default back to these rules, okay? And you take whatever factual setting you're given and take a look at the rules and say, okay, what do I have here? Okay? Is there a contract in effect? Is there a term in effect? If there is, okay, which of these rules apply? Is there a term? Is there no term? Right? Over here, well, there's no contract in effect. If this is a situation where negotiations in progress, are they not in progress? Right? And to the extent you don't know or don't have that information, you need it, right? The answer to the question is you need to know whether or not, right? That's how to analyze those situations. And it usually doesn't fail, you know? And then, why did I go through this? And why did I select this to go through? That comes up all the time. I'm not going into these subjects because, you know, for my health or trying to put you through torture. There's actually case law in the book that discusses this. I didn't assign it to you to read because you can only read so many cases, frankly. Jacob's Manufacturing in the book, it's somewhere in 900 somewhere, is where this stuff is discussed, particularly number 3 is where they go into that. And there are cases after the touch upon like the Walker spring. You know, I could have made that a whole big section of this course, but I chose not to. And I gave you other things in here, more what I thought practical things like the rules about commerce. And we talked about more concrete practice and procedure issues in here, like showing of interest and, you know, our case, the representation case procedure, and how a petition goes from beginning to end. Because I quite frankly thought that was more valuable. I chose to focus on that stuff. We even hit upon secondary boycotts in here, recognition of picketing, which at least secondary boycotts, ordinarily many labor law courses, survey labor law courses, won't go into that. But I did, because I'm trying to focus on areas that come up, you know, so that when you come out of here, you've got a good flavor of the more common issues, at least that arise in this jurisdiction. I can't speak to what goes on in New Mexico or, you know, elsewhere across the country, but that was what I was trying to do here. But, make sense? Okay. The last case that was assigned was First National Maintenance. I'll go into this quickly. This comes up not all that frequently, but if you think back, we had a case like this, shutdowns, where the employer has more than one facility or more than one department of a facility. And the question in this case is, what's the employer's duty to bargain over a partial shutdown of its operation? And interestingly, this case arose in the Brooklyn office, the NLRB, and it was litigated out of that office, and it wound its way to the Supreme Court. Pretty significant issue. The court here delineates bargaining obligations for you into two types, two varieties. You've got the obligation to bargain over the decision to close, either close your facility or close a portion of it, and the obligation to bargain over the effects of that decision. Those are different concepts. Decisional bargaining, effects bargaining. From a practical standpoint, effects bargaining really is limited to a severance package. It has always been thus. In other words, I'm an employer. I'm going to shut down my Hartford facility. I'm going to keep my New York facility open. What's my obligation to bargain? The court, in this case, says, I don't have to bargain over the decision to shut down, but I do have to bargain over the effects. Why is it a close case? Well, it's a close issue when it got to the Supreme Court because of the idea that if given an opportunity to bargain over the decision, maybe the union could have helped the employer avoid making that decision, could have reversed that decision and kept the facility open so that bargaining unit employees would continue to be employed and wouldn't need a severance package, right? The court didn't go for that. Instead, the court found for the employer and its, I guess you would call it its corporate right, if you will, or within the ambit of its corporate rights or entrepreneurial rights to make such a decision. I don't quite like this too much because it kind of cuts the union short and doesn't give it a chance to reverse the decision. Yeah.
Isn't that similar to the case we did earlier where the employer is allowed to shut down based on financial reasons without talking to the union at all?
Well, a little bit, but where they should. If you're talking about, I might have touched on shutting down in a financial exigency. We talked a little bit about that, but we also talked about it in the context of you may be thinking of a threat to close versus a prediction of closure based on objective fact. That's a different issue, really. That's really going to weigh in on what is said to these employees. Is it a threat to close or is it a reasonable prediction based on objective fact? This is different. Here, the closure is taking place, okay? What not to be confused by, if you read the case, was a situation where the closure is motivated by a desire to chill union activity elsewhere at a different plant. That's Darlington. And they talk all about, if you read First National Maintenance, as you were assigned to do, they talk all about Darlington in there. And they say, that's not this. You know, this is different. Here, the question is not whether or not the employer is shutting down facility number two to chill unionization in facility number one. Here, the issue is, what bargaining obligation does the employer have with the union to partially shut down? In other words, shut down facility number two as opposed to facility number one. Do they have to bargain over the decision or merely over the effects? Court finds merely over the effects. And that's dramatic. Why? Because we're talking about the difference between when you think about it from a practical standpoint. Employer has an effects bargaining obligation. Now the employer can come to the table and say, okay, I made a decision to shut down the Hartford plant. Okay? So let's go and talk about a severance package. I'm willing to give these guys X amount of money. And he's like, well, okay. How about X plus one? Well, we'll talk about it when we get back to you. Instead of, think of the decisional bargaining context. Union, I want to shut down Hartford. Oh, wait a minute. You're not going to shut down Hartford. Look, my actuary came up with a plan that could enable you to keep Hartford open. Well, I don't know. My actuary says something different. My accountant tells me I can't survive. He's wrong. I'll bring my account to the table. Here, if you cut on marketing here and you channel the money into a different area, you could stay open. I don't know if I guess maybe I should stay open, right? Now it's a completely different framework where maybe the place is going to stay open instead of how much do I have to pay to these guys now that I'm going to close it. See the difference? It's a huge, huge difference. Very significant. And the only other thing that really comes up in the area, it doesn't come up in the case, you know, go crazy with it, is that where the employer does blow off its effects bargaining obligation, which, believe me, the employers who are shutting down, whether it's a portion of their business or anything else where they have an effects bargaining obligation, they routinely blow off their effects bargaining obligation in this context. despite the fact that the court has given them basically, you know, a free ride here to simply bargain over the effects, I cannot tell you the number of employers that simply don't do it. When the employers don't do it, there is a case called Transmarine Navigation that requires the employer to actually pay back pay to the employees for a reasonable period of time. In other words, to put them back in the position they would have been in but for the unlawful refusal to bargain over the effects. Usually we, the labor board and board cases, rule that something on the order of 3 weeks of back pay to put these employees back there where they would have been if the employer had properly bargained over the effects is fair. It's not a lot of money for the most part, unless it's a large bargaining unit. But it's something that's transferring. That's not even in here, and it really doesn't come up all that much. I just wanted you to understand that that's a sort of a sub-issue that exists here. So that basically does conclude the substantive portion of the class. We've gone through everything that I wanted to cover, debated by the skin of my teeth. So I think at this point, I'll make a few closing remarks to you and let you take a break. After the break, you guys can come back and we'll go through the sample question. And I'll answer any questions anyone has about anything. Hopefully I have the answer. I'm just kidding. I'm sure I do. But and I'll stay as long as anyone wants. And at the conclusion of that, as I said, for the people who were forced to listen to the incomplete podcast, I'll go through what you missed. I think if we've had a theme in here, it's been about harmony in the doctrines that we've studied. And it's often been against the backdrop of my venting about certain board decisions. I talked to you about Dana and my opposition to that decision, simply because of the fact that it doesn't really match with contract bar rules. Contract bar rules insulate the union at the conclusion of its contract, absent the window period that we talked about. Why? Because the feeling is that the union needs to focus on bargaining a contract in that last little 60-day period toward the termination of the agreement, right? So why in Dana doesn't the union get the reasonable period of time after a voluntary recognition to bargain a contract? Whether bargaining a contract at the conclusion of the existing one or bargaining a contract at the very beginning of negotiations, the concern is really the same, yet the law is not in harmony anymore. Was at one time. We talked about the good faith doubt standard, which has been abandoned, which used to apply to both pre-election situations where a demand for recognition was made and the employer used to not be able to say no absent a good faith doubt. And the same matched, that good faith doubt standard matched where the employer wanted to withdraw recognition. Of course, the good faith doubt standard has been abandoned. But there was a harmony there that is not there anymore. We talked about that concept against the backdrop of Leachmere and Excelsior. Leachmere, of course, the situation where the union agents, union organizers, access is limited to private property unless it can show no reasonable alternative means, the test, of course, which it can never meet. And only then, once it can meet the test it can never meet, do we do a balance of Section 7 rights versus private property rights. Yet, Excelsior Underwear compels the employer, after a petition has been filed and an election has either been directed or agreed to furnish an eligibility list to the union. They get access to the list, but they don't get access to the private property. Why not? I don't know why not. I think they should. Why is there this need for harmony in these doctrines? I think the reason, at least the one that I come up with, is that fundamentally, that's what the National Labor Relations Act is trying to do. You should always ask yourself at the beginning of studying any law, what are the goals and objectives of this law? What are the goals of punishment in criminal law? You ask yourself that question on day one of law school, and you may ask yourself that question at the beginning of studying any law, especially this one. What are the goals of the National Labor Relations Act? Isn't it to even the playing field to some degree? To give employees rights in the workplace they otherwise would not have had. Don't the rules need to balance a bit? In many situations, they do. But in many situations, they don't. And I hope that I was able to convey that theme throughout these documents. It's conceivably difficult to wrap up a semester-long course in only a few minutes. You know, we've gone through quite a bit in here. Many, many rules and doctrines. I can only, in leaving you with some parting thoughts, think back to my contracts class, which I took here. And my contract professor had a theme for her course. She told us throughout the class that contract law was designed to make the world a better place. And we only could constantly think that maybe it's designed to make the world a better place for the people out there, but for the people in the contract class, it was really not making the world a particularly good place. Anyway, I think that's true of all law, dictated by, of course, principles of logic that you were introduced to on day one of first year in this place. But a larger theme here, integral to these rules, both statutory and particularly judicially created ones, are the players who are making these rules via litigated decisions. And that's especially true in labor law, where the doctrines are almost always the result of litigated decisions, where you've got attorney for the employer on the one hand, attorney for the union on the other. An issue has arisen, a dispute. Through the litigation process, the board has looked at both sides of this and has issued a decision, and that decision contains a holding, and the holding is the rule. What I'm getting at here, particularly true here, is that it really all boils down to you. You remember I've said to you in here that despite my stress of importance on labor law since I'm teaching it, but I always felt that lawyer's ethics was perhaps the most important course you took here, even though it's 2 credits. Why is that? It's the underpinnings of everything else. The system does not work without your zealous advocacy and our ability to collectively grasp what that means. And that's not easy, but I guess I would say to you that it's true, particularly in labor law, regardless of who you represent. Whether you're a social activist and you represent employees of the union, or you're Jackson Lewis back there and you're representing the interests of management, your actions, your strategies, the things that you do and the manner in which you do them will make a difference in people's lives. Your clients, whether they're employers or unions or employees, their lives rest in the balance. That is to say, their working lives. They rest in your hands. And often, the decisions that you make make the difference in their lives, whether they have a job or don't have a job, whether they lose a big contract of hundreds of thousands of dollars or they retain it. Whether or not they're able to feed a family or not feed a family. We spend the majority of our time at work. And when one loses a job, and admittedly this is particularly true of employees, it is a dramatic, dramatic loss. If you've ever lost a job, then you would know that. Especially true when jobs are scarce, as they are increasingly scarce now. Why do I go into all this? I think because you need to understand the importance of what you do in order to grasp that concept of zealous advocacy, in order to understand exactly what that takes, you know. And I go back to a couple of examples of situations that came up in cases I investigated. I will never forget the employees of Domino Sugar. The Domino Sugar factory closed down several years ago after a bitter strike that lasted the better part of 2 years and failed miserably. Left employees with virtually no marketable skills who had worked at the plant for 25, 30 years, their entire careers, without a job, and with maybe enough money to live on for 4 months, 6 months. It might look like a nice, hefty piece of change initially, but when it runs out and you can't get a job, and you've worked at the same job for 25 years, the situation is dire. Now, am I blaming their lawyer? No. Do not misunderstand. But what am I telling you that the advocacy of a lawyer could make a difference there? You bet it could. The workers of Toupin, who I spoke to you about earlier this semester, 30 employees who only knew their rights by virtue of a leaflet distributed to them from a local advocacy group, not lawyers, mind you, had gone out on an economic strike. They could have been permanently replaced, but thankfully, a couple of lawyers found them, a union lawyer and an advocate for them, for the employees themselves, and took the right steps to enable them to convert their economic strike into an unfair labor practice strike, which would make a dramatic difference in whether they could be permanently replaced or not. A lawyer made a difference in their lives. And we see it over and over again that your work as lawyers can and does make a difference in working people's lives. So I guess I would leave you with this thought, that your clients are, in certain circumstances, many circumstances, you are the only, or the last and best friend that they have, whether they be employees or employers. So when you are out there practicing and you are working late, writing that brief, and it's getting late and you're getting tired, and you feel like you're at your wit's end, and you really need to go home or get something to eat or do whatever it is that you want to do, remember those clients. Remember that their lives rest in the balance, and literally rest in the palm of your hands. And think back to your study of labor law. If you become a labor or employment lawyer, whatever you choose to practice, and suck it up and find that little bit extra deep inside to put in the extra hour, find the extra case, make the extra argument. It will make all the difference in the world. I've seen it day in and day out in my own practice and in the lawyers who practice before the NLRB. Thank you very much for listening, and take a break, and there's cookies when you come back.
Last piece that we just did when we talked about that on my strike, closing down the plant, right? So if that was done just for today, well, that's a former union, it changes things, right? If it was just a pretext case, but a court case, does that make sense?
Well,
just incorporating other areas of class. Because that's how it's going to happen. I mean, sometimes they're going to say you don't have enough money. Sometimes they're also going to say that.
Well, listen,
if the union wants more money,
the motive. Well, yeah, I mean, if the motive is bad, then maybe there's a problem, you know? But it depends. My situation, for financial maintenance, there already was a union in place. Okay? So, thanks. The bargaining obligation was already there. You know? So it's different than your situation where you're saying that, you know, union is coming in. Right? I mean, here, the first national labor focus is strictly on the bottom line. But again, you have to do it. It comes up over time. You have to be able to analyze, you know, what your facts are. I guess I always said it was open book, but it was always limited open book.
Okay, so I guess I'm just wondering about this question. So basically, your notes, your textbook, and your textbook.
You know, it's your notes. Your notes, okay, the statutory supplement, anything I handed out, like the outline of no, no commercially produced outlines, no outlines that you purchase from somebody else, no search on but that it always makes it less. Okay. And but no developing label and stuff. But frankly, I gotta tell you, even if you use and I let you bring in Gilbert or one of those things, you wouldn't want to write that much. I think it would do you a disservice, quite frankly, rather than help you, because we went deep in a certain way, and you're going to write from good, which you're going to get a point. So I think it would hurt you.
All right, for the no contract, number 3,
uh-huh.
It doesn't have to be mandatory, right? It does. So if it's a permissive subject, and there's
a permissive subject, then all that relates is that somebody wants this done, and the other side says, no, that's it. You're not going to have this notice and opportunity and stuff like this. It doesn't ordinarily come up in business.
But what if it did? That they're like, union, we're going to do this, and they don't say anything.
In a permissive subject, they don't say anything? I suppose the same standard applies. You'd have to say no. It's incumbent on the party that doesn't want it to happen, in a permissive subject, to speak up and say no.
Right.
But it doesn't land itself.
Then if there was permission, they would just say no. And that would be
right. What are permissive subjects? Paper coding negotiations, internal funds. Like, remember that I told you about the interlocal pension fund that came up in Bali House of Graphics? It's not going to impact terms and conditions anyway. The union is going to say, employer, I'm going to have everybody contribute. What the hell is that going to do anyway? Even if he said no, you'd be like, so? He can say no as much as he wants. It has nothing to do with him. You know? It all depends on the context in which it comes up. Usually these rules wouldn't be able to apply them to permissive subjects.
Right.
You know, it would be weird.
All right, so pretty much you're not going to write that in the third
time. I can try to come up with an example where that would come up. I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think it would.
Okay.
Yeah. So then,
so
Thank you.
Oh, you know.
Yeah, thanks for the service. We have like any questions after class, like as we're preparing, is there any way that we could contact you?
Yeah,
go back there.
These are really good. These are pieces.
Those are much better than mine. You have an email, man. You have an email. You got my email address?
Yeah, I gave it
four. I will be here Saturday.
On
9:45 or 10:45.
Okay.
Are you going to be here this Saturday?
Yeah. All right.
Thanks. I'm going for it.
Oh, you're going for it? Yeah. They sent me an email. Yeah, email me. I won't be able to do it tomorrow if I'm not in, but on Wednesday I'll do it. I'll send it
to that. I have a feeling it's deja vu.
I was looking for you. I'm looking for everybody, actually.
Yeah.
Did everybody get the sign-in sheet? Going once. I always see. said that it was, whether I characterized it as limited open book, I always said you couldn't bring in commercial outlines.
Maybe that. See, I don't know, maybe my definition is not one of the it's just a place where
they even have.
Yeah, they what is this? Either way, it's still you got to know
Do you guys want me to start by going through the sample question? Is that a good way to open this up?
I have a question.
All right.
Yeah, so when I did this question, I was assuming that it was not the entire exam, like it would be one of two questions, or that's how I timed myself. Like I only gave this is a 3-hour exam, right?
Right, the exam.
So I only gave myself an hour and a half to get through the entire thing.
Well, the exam consists of 3 questions.
So that I would only have an hour for that.
Well, how you choose to spread your time is up to you. But the questions are, in terms of grading, are weighted equally. I mean, I can't tell you how long it's going to take you to answer.
This is an example of one of each question.
Say again?
One of each question will be like this kind of thing.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I would say. Want to go through it? Okay, probably a good place to start. Alright, expert engineering is a contract in which services utilities, including gas, water, and electric companies. Expert employs locators who spray paint the street at the point at which these utilities maintain underground pipes and wires so that when excavating is done, the pipes and wires won't be ruined. I'm not making this up, it really does exist, okay? Look on the street. Okay, and you will see somebody see spray painted orange or green, usually in a bright color. Little symbols and letters, you have no idea what they mean. But people who spray paint know exactly what they mean, and Con Ed, out here at Keystone and National Grid, at the phone company, they know exactly what it means. Because when construction is being done and excavating needs to be done, whichever contractor is doing this now knows, whoa, don't dig there because I'm going to crash into a pipe. If you crash into a gas pipe, guess what happens? Major explosion. The locator can't mess that up, okay? That would be a really, really bad thing to do. Anyway, it's a real industry and there are real companies that do it. Okay. Expert maintains 2 facilities, one in Hempstead and the other in Piscataway, New Jersey. It employs 20 employees at each facility. Fearing unionization efforts, Hempstead facility manager Tommy Tech decides to form a committee to deal with issues concerning anything and everything in the workplace. 5 employees, Supervisor Larry Lead and Tech, sit on the committee. If a problem arises, the affected person presents it. The 7-person group discusses it. Lead makes a recommendation and Tech a final decision. The decisions are not reviewable. This works so well that Perry Winkle, Experts Facility Manager in Piscataway, forms such a committee there. But this raises a case that we read earlier in the semester called Electromation, where such committees may constitute labor organizations that are dominated by the employer in violation of Section 882. What probably is pivotal here is that the committee deals with issues concerning anything and everything in the workplace. That's pretty broad. it probably weighs in favor of a finding that this committee crosses the line and is one that is dominated by the employer, particularly considering the context of lead making a recommendation. He's the supervisor. Tech making the final decision. The decisions are not even reviewable. This sounds like the employer is dominating this little committee. So it's an electromation issue. Both facilities stay union-free until an energetic organizer for Electrical Workers Local 52, Dora Diego, starts talking to the Hempstead employees about joining her union. A socially active employee at the Hempstead facility, Max Ruby, encourages his colleagues there to join Local 52, calling a meeting of those interested at a nearby diner. He drives seven of his co-workers to the diner and notices that Larry Lead is following him close behind. When Ruby gets to the diner, he sees Lead still in his car, peering at him and his six co-workers. It's starting to sound like surveillance. We talked about surveillance in here. Ruby and his six co-workers go into the diner where they are joined by five more expert employees. All 12 sign Local 52 authorization cards Ruby has given them. Only Ruby sees Lead still peering at all of them as Ruby hands out the cards. So now you've got evidence that the employer, in the form of the supervisor, is engaging in surveillance of union activity, namely these employees signing the cards. And we know that Ruby sees this going on, right? Okay. So you've got surveillance. The next day, Tech meets all 20 employees and states as follows. Quote, I know you've been talking about joining Local 52, but there are some things you need to know. Our economy sucks right now, and it has hit expert as bad as anyone. Business is terrible. We've lost 30% of our customers in the last quarter alone. The Local 52 contract in our area has a $45 an hour wage rate. Guys, we cannot afford that. My accountant tells me that if we have to pay that or the costs of bargaining with Local 52, we will not survive in Hempstead and the plant will close. Gissel, is this a prediction based on objective fact, or does it cross the line and become a threat to close the facility? Well, he's relying on stuff that he claims that his accountant has told him. You know, he's obviously looked into what the wage rate is. It's kind of close. It's online, but you could certainly make arguments both ways here. I think, based on the fact that he's said here that, you know, he's explained the financial circumstances that the company is in, and he showed that he's investigated this. It's probably looking like a lawful prediction based on objective fact. What would have helped if he had had a report to hand to these workers? And you might want to point that out. Yeah.
When deciding whether it's prediction, should we look at previous behavior? Should we take the surveillance into account?
You could. I don't know if it would completely carry the day, but it's an argument you could make. Yes. I think, despite that, I might still, in making a final conclusion, decide that that was a pretty lawful prediction. Yeah.
So the fact that he said it was convincing was enough, you know,
he could have just been bluffing. Well, he could have been bluffing, but he's gone a little bit farther than that. He has checked into the wage rate in the contract, you know? I mean, the fact is that, sure, he could have been bluffing, but to come up with 30% of our customers, it's unlikely that he came up with that out of thin air, you know? It's probably true. Like I said, it would have been better if he had something to hand to those workers, and you can say that. Yeah?
Is this part of the issue of the union being able to inspect the books to see if this is true? Or?
No. Why not?
This is not a bargaining thing?
Exactly. Well, you know, there's no bargaining obligation. This union has neither been recognized by the employer, nor has it been certified pursuant to an NLRB election. So the duty to furnish information is a function of that bargaining good faith obligation. There's no obligation to bargain in good faith. The union is not either recognized or certified. Okay, where are we? Oh, 3 days later, right? Tech fires Ruby for arriving 10 minutes late for work. Ruby reminds Tech that he's been late at least once a week for 5 years. Tech replies, too bad, you're out of here. This is a straight, right line sort of application. You know from earlier in the fact pattern that the employer knows that Ruby was handing out the cards since Lead saw him doing it, right? You know that you've got timing on Ruby's side, since this is happening 3 days after he was seen handing out the cards. And there's the issue we talked about, condonation. Obviously, he's being fired purportedly for arriving late, right? 10 minutes late for work, yet he's been late at least once a week for the last 5 years. The employer has condoned that for 5 years, yet all of a sudden is just using it as a justification for the discharge. Sounds like a pretext. Yeah?
Is that the Dutchess case or whatever? Is that...
No, I see what stuck out in this court. No, that was not the Dutchess case. However, it followed close after that. It was a case called Brightline, which appeared in the book as a note case, I believe. And we talked about, and I highlighted on the board, the standards, or the four, it's really four prongs that comprise the initial burden. It's a burden-shifting analysis. The first burden is on the employee to show that union activity was a motivating factor underlying the action taken against her. Here, it was a discharge, right? So you've got union activity was the first prong. Knowledge was the second. We certainly have that in the form of Larry Lee peering at them while they're handing out cards, right? You do need... you're looking for animus, but animus you don't always have to have direct evidence of. It can be inferred, and we talked about that here by virtue of the fourth prong being the causal connection. Here you've got both timing and condonation present on these facts. So in those circumstances, certainly there's a strong showing from the initial burden. What is the employer going to show on the shifting burden? Not much, because the stated reason here was you arrived late. If you conclude that that's pretextual, well, frankly, the employer is probably not going to be able to show that she had an independent reason to justify the discharge, a la evidence that Ruby hit somebody in the head with a mallet on the same day, right? You know, something like that. And we talked about that example. So that's a straight right line sort of analysis. I'm sorry? The causal connection, yes. And you do that through both the timing and the combination. Exactly. Now, too bad you're out of here, right? Meanwhile, Diego has gone to the facility in Piscataway and on her own convinced 10 of the 20 employees there to sign over 52 cards. When he hears about this, Winkle, who of course is the Piscataway manager, meets with tech and expert CEO Fred Rydell. Rydell reviews financials of both the Piscataway and Hempstead facilities and decides that Winkle can battle a union more effectively than Tech. Rydell says, quote, "Listen, if we shut down Hempstead, lay everyone off there and transfer Tech to supervising Piscataway, everyone in Piscataway will hear about what unionizing got for the guys in Hempstead. Winkle, I want you to say whatever you have to say to convince your guys to reject Global 52. Rydell puts the plan in place. Hempstead is shut down, and Tech arrives in Piscataway, upon which Winkle meets with the 20 employees. Right there, you've got Darlington. The employer is shutting down a facility to chill union activity elsewhere. Yeah?
In the example, when we're explaining the applicable Washington site case, according to the board decision in Darlington...
It's funny you ask that. That's not required, no. If you feel more comfortable doing that, if that makes you feel better about your answer, I don't object to it, but I won't mark you off for not doing that. When I took labor law, there was a vicious rumor going around that our professor gave you extra to citing the case. And 14 people must have asked him 28 times, should we cite the case, should we cite the case? He finally got so exasperated, he didn't know what to say anymore. I leave it to your discretion. If you want to, you can. You won't lose points for not. Okay? I'm being serious about that. Honestly, you don't have to cite the case. I don't know. Sometimes people feel more comfortable with their answer if they put a citation in there. You feel better about it. Go ahead.
With the
violation that you, I guess you have to do, that this is a major fee violation, you have to say the exception of the violation.
Yeah, it'd be better if you did that, sure. To the extent that you recognize it's a violation, you certainly would get credit and spot the issue, even if you don't identify the specific section. But I think you'd be best served by spotting the section. Yeah, absolutely. Good question. And I think that would make your answer better and more complete. Okay. So now we got Darlington, and now Winkle meets with all 20 employees and says, quote, "If you guys vote for a reunion, you will all be fired." No, guess what's going on here? That's a threat to close, and it's illegal, right? 8A1. You saw what happened to the guys in Hempstead, right? If I even get an inkling one of you is talking union, that person is gone immediately. Threat of discharge. Dead. And believe me, I know who the supporters are, and you'll see what happens to you. Impression of surveillance. Talked about that as well. And we gave examples of it. And believe, oh, I'm sorry, I said that earlier. Bottom line, this place closes up if you join the union. Threat to close. No guessing. Right? Now he says, no handing out leaflets, no talking about the union, period. Overly broad, no solicitation or distribution rule under Republic Aviation. That comes up. These are employees he's talking to, not employee organizers, not union organizers. It's not a Leachman situation. It's not a Babcock Wilcox. It's a Republic Aviation. He's given a blanket rule against handing out union leaflets or talking about the union. That's an unlawful rule. The next day, five of the card signers are fired, Winkle telling them that they've been discharged for signing union cards. Well, hell, that's a gimp. I don't think he needed a label on me, but all exams have to have a gimme, so there's your gimme. Word of the termination spreads rapidly, and Diego is unable to garner any support at all for Local 52. Well, now she lost whatever support she had, right? She files a charge at the NLRB and asks for a bargaining order. The question here in that issue is she entitled to a bargaining order? Well, the way to analyze that, I think, is under the other Gissel, and whether or not we have what we refer to as hallmark violations, right? And you certainly have them here. Threats to close, right? Blanket prohibitions on union activity, threat to discharge anyone even with an inkling that they're engaging in union activity. But there's a very little thing in here that makes this problematic. I told you all that you can't have a bargaining order without a majority. She's got 10 of 20 cards. 10 of 20 does not make a majority, regardless of how much support she's lost. She never had the majority. She's not entitled to the bargain. Yeah?
She could have asked for an election, right?
She could have done that, but the facts don't give you that. She sure could have on 10 of 20. Remember, this is important also. We talked about in our case procedure, the showing of interest is 30%. Well, it doesn't take a mathematician or a calculator to tell you that 10 out of 20 is more than 30%. Yeah.
Can you back up to surveillance?
Yes, I can, and I'll get to you in a second.
For the impression of surveillance, isn't it the standard that you have to, because that's if like an informant or someone to kind of spy to see if there's union activity. So for the impression of surveillance, don't you have to show proof?
No.
The employer, like,
let me explain that. No. When the employer is merely speaking to you, rather than actually engaging in the surveillance, which you have on these facts, where the employer actually tells you or makes a statement to the effect of, I know you're supporting the union. I know who the supporters are. That gives the employee listener the impression that his or her union activity was being kept under surveillance. Only the remark is necessary. You don't need actual proof that they did it. The remark is the coercive 8A1 violation. Okay? And that's the distinction between the impression of surveillance and the actual surveillance. Okay? John?
Yeah, regarding the absence of majority, could you also argue that the NLRB could have decided the bargaining unit included both Scataway and Hempstead, in which case all 40 employees, and she got 12 from the employees at the Hempstead facility, so that she would have a majority.
What'd she have, 12 and...
12 of 20 there.
She'd have 22 out of 40. Yeah, that's nice, except that argument is a loser. I'll tell you why. Where's Hempstead? You're in it, are you not? Does anyone know where Piscataway, New Jersey is?
I live right
there. Do you?
In Highland Park.
Oh, that's good. All you would need to know is that it's in another state. How are you going to argue that the employees over in Hempstead have a community of interest with the employees over in Piscataway with nothing on the fact pattern to show any interchange whatsoever? I talked about community of interest. That argument would be nice from the social activist standpoint. Okay. Sorry, but I got a call it like I see it, you know? Jackson Lewis in the back had a remark.
There was a minority card, and like an election wouldn't do anything because it chilled the Senate.
Right.
And then you can say, yeah, you can't have party.
Yeah! And what's an election going to do for her now? She lost her support, right? Because of all these egregious unfair labor practices this employer committed. Firing 5 card signers, making all these illegal remarks, right? Sure. Then she needs that bargaining order, and that's where you'd get your gizzle if she had that majority. Absolutely. Why would she go for an election now? Why, to go and lose? That doesn't seem like it makes a whole lot of sense. We had a case not that long ago where we had all kinds of remarks just like this, right? And a union with a majority of cards, right? Didn't want a bargaining order. We asked, which probably went beyond where, you know, we ordinarily might go, and said, union, are you sure you don't want a bargaining order? No, we don't want that. You know what that tells me? And my sort of, I guess, Machiavellian mind, or my my investigative antennas always up, there's something wrong with those cards. They were either, I don't know who signed them, or they were coerced, or whatever. Why would you want to go to an election when you lost all your support? To lose? For what? I'm not quite sure I understand the reasoning there. But, yeah, the point you made is well taken, that it would be a situation where she would want the bargaining order. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think a word to the wise, please, when you're studying for the exam, don't sit here and rehash this question over and over again and think, oh, I just have to study this question and these issues and I'll easily do that. You know how much more we went over in this month? I mean, come on. Please. I'm not looking for people to do poorly on the exam. I want you to do well. I certainly don't want you to do that. This was given as a sample so that you could get an idea of the type of question or the layout of the question, you know, because there's nothing on file for me other than strikes. I don't even have the strikes exams on file, but even if they were, that would really scare people because that goes into issues that we never talked about in here. You think, whoa, I'm in big trouble. I don't know what this is all about. Well, I wouldn't expect you to know what it's about since it's an entirely different course. So I thought that would be really, it would sort of be a waste of time to give you a question from that past exam. So I thought, and Sandra raised it, you know, and I thought it was a good idea to do a sample question for that reason, you know, and take it at face value. I'm not saying these issues are not on the exam or they are on the exam. I'm not going to tell you what's on the exam. What am I? Kind of a professor tells you what's on the exam, you know, but it's simply to give you a layout of the type of question you'll. Yeah.
In the first class, in this chunk of the second class, a lot of what we talked about in the reading was background history. I'm guessing that like what we should pull away from that is that's some of like, the larger themes and some of the greater ideas come out of. Is like what should we do? I am not asking what's on the exam.
Of course you are. You're doing it in a worldly way. What
should you pull out of
the history? Well, let me answer that question this way. I talked about a lot of different things, and I discussed a lot of different items that some of which came up in cases, many of which did not come up in cases. I don't know, could you envision me asking a question about labor history on the exam? Good to know labor history. I'm not going to tell you that, you know, I'll tell you what I'll do. Since you asked it in a lawyerly way, which was basically sort of, you know, beating around the bush to get me to tell you what's on the exam.
No, I don't want to do that either.
But I think it's important that you understand the backdrop that led to all of what we discussed. Is there a question on the exam that says, please analyze the history of the Norris-LaGuardia Act and Yellow Book contracts? No. Okay? That question is not on the exam. If you can call anything from the sample question, the question's on the exam, I like the sample questions. Could I throw in some aspect of labor history? Yeah, I suppose. Sure, you should know it. I want you to know it, you know? I mean, is there some way that it would apply for one of the questions on the exam? I don't remember what the questions are anymore. I wrote it already, you know? Which is, I came in here with that intention, so that I wouldn't remember the thing, right? So I couldn't give anything away. Yeah?
I have a commerce question. The outflow and inflow, each has to be
Well, wait a minute. Let's back up. You got outflow and inflow applicable to non-retail. Okay? In retail, it's going to be a certain amount of gross revenue. Okay, let's do retail first. Retail is going to be this gross revenue, and it depends on the industry. I mean, in your book, I forget what page, I think page 100 or so, they list all of the different retail standards. Let's open this up. It's worth doing. Yeah, what's this? They go into, maybe it was in the 90s. Here we go, in 87. If you open up page 87, there are this retail concerns. And they say generally $500,000 of gross volume of business, okay? Now, then they list a whole bunch of others that have different gross volumes. Skip the non-retail and you go to these other things like interstate commerce and utilities and transit systems, right? Hospitals are on the next page, that's 250. So it all depends on the type of business. But ordinarily, a retail concern is $500,000. In addition, the retail concern also has to do $5,000 or de minimis, if you will, either direct inflow, direct outflow, indirect inflow, indirect outflow. Okay? That's when you get to that direct, indirect stuff in the retail. What you're talking about on the $50,000 is in the non-retail. Okay?
So the $5,000 has to be from indirect, indirect, out of state, and retail.
Yes, in the retail. No, in addition to the $500,000. I mean, certainly the gross volume of sales might be $500,000, but they also need to sell $5,000 of it out of state or purchase. Usually a retail concern will purchase materials from out of state in excess of $5,000. Okay?
You get, for the $5,000, you get financing on direct and indirect outflow.
Probably you can. Yes.
So the same for the non-retail, you get the $50,000 by.
You can aggregate, yes, but practically, I have to tell you, usually $50,000 is such a low standard that ordinarily that issue doesn't come up with aggregating, but yeah, I think you can aggregate. What's more common is a situation in either the retail or the non-retail where the employer does not cooperate with our investigation into commerce at the NLRB and won't furnish books and records relevant to that inquiry, right? Refuses to cooperate with that investigation. In those circumstances, all that is needed is de minimis, inflow, outflow, direct or indirect. When we say de minimis, it can be as little as $100. Does it need to be $5,000? The $50,000 and the $500,000 and the $5,000, those are what we call discretionary standards. Means the NLRB invented them in 1959 to sift out cases that we don't want to waste our time with, okay? That's a decision by the NLRB to not take jurisdiction that it would have over certain entities that don't meet the discretionary level. However, where an employer won't cooperate with the Commerce investigation and is blowing us off, then the NLRB can dispense with the discretionary standard and can simply show de minimis, like $100. Yeah.
When you have a non-retail service employer, like someone, you know, a carpenter's union or something like that, or a carpenter...
Carpentry contractor.
Right, and then, you know, they're trying to get that. How would you... Would that commerce inquiry still come into play? And if so,
absolutely.
Well, how do you prove that carpentry in commerce if they're just locally, you know...
Well, that's where you get into the indirect standard a little bit. Your example is a carpentry contractor that goes on to various construction sites, right, and performs work for general contractors or construction companies. Okay. The carpentry contractor is non-retail. Therefore, you're in that 50,000 area. There's direct inflow, indirect inflow, direct outflow, or indirect outflow. So, on inflow, perhaps the carpentry contractor purchases $50,000 worth of wood from the plant in Ohio. That would be direct inflow. Or perhaps the carpentry contractor, though local, does work out of state and does some work in New Jersey in excess of $50,000. Direct outflow. On the other hand, let's say the carpentry contractor works exclusively in New York, but works for Hunter Roberts or works for Bovis, one of these big construction managers, right? If they perform, the carpentry contractor performed $50,000 worth of work in state for Bovis, provided that Bovis is directly in commerce, then so is the carpentry contractor. That's the indirect outflow standard. Indirect, because they're performing work for somebody else. Outflow, the work is being performed for a construction manager, right? The inflow is going to be the purchase of materials from somebody in state who in turn purchased them from out of state.
Now, when you're opportunity the prices of the services rendered, like for your outflow, is it the price of the final, like the, for example, if carpenters working for a contractor on a building owned by someone else, value the person is paying the contractor?
The value of the contract. It's the value of the contract. So let's say I'm a carpentry contractor, and I have a subcontract with Bovis to do the carpentry work on the building on the corner of California Avenue, right? The Bovis is paying me, the carpentry contractor, $350,000 to do the work, okay? It's the value of the contract, which is in excess of $50,000, that is dispositive of that inquiry. Yeah.
You keep both the inflow and outflow standards, right? You keep both.
It's not
just one.
Only one. Oh. Inflow or outflow. You meet one.
They
all you have to do is
meet
one.
They add up to it.
And they can add up. Yes. Yeah.
What was... You said that you disfavored the payment of the... What was the issue that you had with it?
The data, if you recall, comes up in voluntary recognition, where an employer has voluntarily recognized the union based on a lawful card majority, right? The union is obtained the majority of the cards in a bargaining unit, and the employer has recognized the union. It used to be that once that union was voluntarily recognized, it was entitled to a reasonable amount of time, not to exceed a year, to bargain a contract. And during that reasonable amount of time, not to exceed a year, it was entitled to an irrebuttable presumption of majority status. In other words, another union couldn't attack that or file a petition for an election, right? It was called the recognition bar. Dana changes all that. What Dana does is, once the recognition is conferred voluntarily, unless and until the recognized union or employer asks the NLRB for a notice, a Dana notice, that the employer must post on the wall for 45 days that advises employees of their right to a decertification election or their right to have another union file a petition at the labor board seeking an election or representative status, right? The recognized union doesn't get the reasonable period. So think about how it practically plays out. I'm the union and I get voluntarily recognized, right? In order to be free of rival unions attacking me and trying to get my members or employees in the bargaining unit, I should say, to switch to a different union. Or, in order to be free of the concern, as the recognized union would want to be free of the concern, that some employee is going to want to decertify me, right? In order to get that reasonable amount of time during which my majority status can't be challenged, that irrebuttable presumption of majority status, I need to have a note put on the wall for 45 days at the beginning of my bargaining relationship with the employer, telling everybody, even though I've been recognized, anybody who wants to file a decert petition at the labor board can do so and the NLRB will run an election, or another union wants to represent the employees, on a proper showing of interest, of course, both situations, that union can file a representation petition seeking an election. So I'm going to try to bargain a contract with this employer during that 45-day period, a pivotal time in our relationship, knowing that I may have to very well defend my majority status when an employee files a decert because she doesn't like the pace at which I'm negotiating, or another union decides to come in and, you know, rouse up sympathies and get enough cards to file for an election. Now, as the recognized union, I don't get that reasonable period anymore. I got to now defend and win an election at the NLRB before I get my reasonable amount of time. Used to be, you got the reasonable amount of time upon recognition being conferred. Now you don't get that reasonable amount of time unless and until the Dana notice goes on the wall and is posted for 45 days. If the Dana notice is posted for 45 days and there's no petition filed, then, and only then, does the reasonable amount of time up to a year trigger, such that from that point forward, for the reasonable amount of time up to a year, now I get this irrebuttable presumption of majority status. Why don't I like that? I don't like that because it subjects the union to defending its majority status at a crucial time in the bargaining relationship when they're trying to negotiate a contract. In contract bar law, you know, of course, that the window period for another union or somebody wanting to decertify to file a petition is in the 30-day window between days 60 and 90 to go on the contract. When past day 60, the union now is insulated from attack because they're focusing on bargaining a contract. How come from day 60 to day 1 at the conclusion of the contract is the union insulated, but at the beginning of the relationship under Dana, the union is subject to attack? That's why I don't like it.
Yeah. But the union, even though they're still trying to fight off the attack, although they can still negotiate if there's a collective bargaining agreement reached, it'll all go back to the employer.
That's, yes. In other words, let's say the union and the employer, during the 45-day period, they reach an agreement, right? If they reach an agreement and no petition is filed, the agreement is now a binding agreement, provided that the note was on the wall the full 45 days. Yeah. Yeah. On the other hand, if during the 45-day period somebody files a petition, and let's say it's a decert petition, and the incumbent union loses the election, whatever contract that union reached is null and void. Yeah. Well, it applied to antitrust laws, but it also applied to Section 8E of the Act, which makes unlawful certain agreements by unions and employers not to do business with third parties. And we talked about in the construction industry is an exemption or a proviso that permits agreements like that. Okay. However, in a case called Canal Construction, the Supreme Court held that the 8E's proviso for protection for agreements like that in the construction industry is limited to situations where those agreements arose out of an existing collective bargaining relationship between the union and the employer. If it didn't, Section 8E's construction industry proviso would not insulate such an agreement, and such an agreement would violate the antitrust laws. The non-statutory exemption would not insulate that kind of agreement from the antitrust laws. Section 8E's proviso would not insulate that type of agreement from a violation of Section 80. From a practical standpoint, a violation of Section 80 is a big who cares when you can collect triple damages on a violation of the antitrust laws. So 80 is kind of like, oh, yeah, yeah, all right, forget about that. I want my triple damages, and I'm telling you to get lost. Okay? Yeah.
This has to do with contract bars. So there's a 30-day window when the bar and the contract are on the same length. When the bar is shorter than the contract, the window period is on the last, like 960 days of the bar.
Let's back up. Can I get rid of this? Does everybody have this? I'm not sure. So you're saying there's a contract of less than 30 days?
No. If the bar is shorter than the contract, specific contract is 5 years, but the contract bar is only 3 years.
Oh, okay. Most contracts are 3 years in duration. If a contract is longer than 3 years, it's a five-year agreement, that contract will only operate as a bar up to the third year. So regardless of the window period, let's say the window period passes and nobody files a petition, okay? But the contract expires and no new agreement is reached, okay? Well, you wouldn't expect the new agreement necessarily to be reached because the parties are still operating under their contract, right? They're not really bargaining because they're in year four, right? They're not talking. They're not worried about window periods. Okay, all that given, past the third year of the contract, that contract is no longer a bar, regardless of window periods, okay? Once you're past the third year of the contract, we're in the middle of year four or the middle of year five, and a rival union wants to file a petition or somebody wants to file a decert petition, that contract will not serve as a bar, okay? On the other hand, where most contracts are 3 years in duration, in those circumstances, right, in your regular industrial situation, you're coming to the termination of a contract here, right? There's 90 days left to go. Here there's 60 days left to go, 30 days left to go. Right in here is the time where a rival union can file a petition seeking an election at the NLRB for purposes of achieving certification, certifying it as the exclusive collective bargaining representative. In most situations, the incumbent union would intervene in that petition and have a spot on the ballot. It would be a choice between neither union number one or union number two, right? But the petition would have to be filed in this window period. If it's outside of the window period, the contract would serve as a bar and majority status could not be challenged. Similarly, here, half the 60 days and all the way to zero, once again, majority status could not be challenged at the NLRB, the contract would serve as a bar. Same goes for the employer who wants to withdraw recognition. During the term of the contract, that contract represents an irrebuttable showing of majority status. When the contract is not in effect, once it's expired, or maybe before it's been entered into, the employer, as you recall, needs proof of actual loss of majority in order to withdraw recognition. The good faith doubt standard is no longer applicable. Yeah?
So, once the union gets recognized, like certified by the NLRB?
Which certified or recognized is a huge difference.
Well, they give the cards and then they have a vote. Then there's an election.
Oh, the NLRB holds the election.
Yeah.
Okay.
NLRB holds the election. And now they're negotiating collective bargaining. The minimum before anybody can do anything is 1 year. So it's 60 to 90 days left at the end of that year. Right?
No. At the end of it, don't confuse two concepts, which is what you've done. One concept is no contract is in effect. The other is where there is a contract in effect. where there's no contract in effect. The union just won an election, right? We win. There's 10 employees in the bargaining unit. We won 8-2. Then NLRB now issues a piece of paper that says certification of representative, right? Means the employer now has to bargain with the union in good faith, right? There's no contract in effect. For 1 year after the certification, which came pursuant to an NLRB election, for 1 year, the union's majority status is irrebuttable. It cannot be challenged, okay? After 1 year, if there's no contract in effect, the presumption becomes rebuttable, okay? And at that point, after the conclusion of the year, that rebuttable presumption can be shown to justify a withdrawal of recognition on proof of actual loss of majority, or if the employer wants an election or an employee wants a decertification election on something less, reasonable suspicion. It's really the withdrawal of recognition and the employer's election, not the decert, where this comes up. The decertification petitioner would still need the 30% showing of interest, okay? Where the 1 year has expired, right, has passed, and there's no contract in effect, right there, it's a rebuttable presumption, turned from an irrebuttable to a rebuttable. And what constitutes evidence of that would cause this rebuttal? In other words, what would meet that rebuttable presumption test? That would be to withdraw recognition, proof of actual loss of majority under Levitz, or for the employer to trigger an election, which she can do, reasonable suspicion. Okay? Different is your situation in which there's a contract in effect, okay? Where the contract is in effect, Levitz is inapplicable. Oh, yeah. Levitz is inapplicable. The contract serves as irrebuttable proof of majority status for the term of the contract. However, if the employees want to get out from this union, right, or they want another union to represent them, they have this little window period toward the conclusion of the contract to file a petition, right? If they don't do that, and the contract expires, and there is no new contract in place, it's back to Levitz, okay? Proof of actual loss or reasonable suspicion. Once the contract's in effect, that changes everything. That's why you have the window period. They know that people don't want to necessarily be mired with one union forever. That's the purpose of the window period. By the way, it's 90-60 for industry, and it's 120-90 for healthcare. It's just a different thing. Yeah.
How do we know, like, good faith impacts has occurred? Like, you really get some factors. Can you sort of tell us about it? Or,
I don't know. I can give you some factors. I talked during the first hour about the length of negotiations, and I talked about what's going on at the bargaining table, what's going on away from it. I talked about the need for good faith. I don't know. It depends on what you're confronted with. Yeah.
So just sort of to go at that point, on the test point, we saw that you brought up the 30% of losing customers in the $45 wage, but just to make an argument in support of points ahead of good faith and what and how on that line, so you can hear my facts.
Sure. I mean, you could argue it both ways. You wouldn't be wrong that's necessarily to it. You know, gone the other way with it and said, look, they didn't really give enough here to make this, you know, a good faith prediction based on objective fact. They mentioned some facts, but they haven't shown it. You wouldn't get marked off for coming to the conclusion that that was a threat. What I'm looking for you to do is to, you know, apply that test to law and recognize that that's the issue. You know, an argument could be made either way. That's kind of close, you know. That's close. You could argue either way. You wouldn't get marked off, I don't think, for coming to the opposite conclusion that I came to here with you. You know, it's a close issue. Yeah.
When unionism is a partial motive for a firing, what was the test?
That's right, Mark. In other words, it's a burden shift that we went through before.
It's
a, well, you're talking about a mixed motive, right? In other words, the situation is that the employer had two reasons for terminating this employee or doing whatever it is she did to him or her, right? One reason was union activity, but there was an independent reason. But once the employee can show that there was union activity, knowledge of the activity, some form of animus, either direct evidence of it or can be inferred, right? And some causal connection represented by timing or combination or disparate treatment we talked about, right? The employee is satisfied her burden. The burden shifts to the employer to show that she would have done it anyway, okay? That's the mixed motive part. But the employer is going to need to be able to show that she would have done it anyway. In other words, she's going to be able to show that the asserted reason she gave is not a pretext, okay? Is not something she made up. Very often, what you'll see in situations is that the employer's kind of goose is kind of cooked in a lot of these cases, because what she has asserted sometimes is evident is pretextual and only lends to the employee's argument. This other situation I gave you, which is the case that I had, where you had union activity on the part of an employee, plenty of animus, there was knowledge of the employee's activity, and the timing was, you know, the discharge was close in time to the union activity. Yes, the employee met that, you know, her burden. But when we found out evidence from the employer that the employee on the same day hit somebody in the head with a hammer, or I think it was a 2x4 actually, knocked this person cold for about 5 days, put him in a concussion and sent him to the hospital, the employer was able to show that nobody had ever done something so egregious at her facility. And that irrespective of the union activity, even assuming that that union activity was a motivating factor underlying the discharge, this employer showed that she would have done it anyway, even in the absence of union activity. That is to say, would have discharged the employee even in the absence of the union activity. So that's the burden shift. There is a true mixed motive where the employer's argument and position will carry the day. Yeah?
Also, you spoke about the issue of glossing over the standard and the burden shift.
I think what I said was that very often, that initially, right line was intended to apply to mixed motive situations, like the one I described, and not situations in which the employer's asserted reason was pretextual, and the evidence showed it was pretextual. And what I told you was, I didn't think it should be necessary for the employee to show union activity, knowledge, which is sometimes hard to show, animus, as well as some theory of timing or combination of disparate treatment, and meet that burden if there's evidence of pretext, okay? Because I thought, and I've always thought, that right line should apply to only the mixed motive cases. However, I also told you that the board law doesn't agree with me, and you would be best advised to apply the law on the exam, okay? I highlighted my position to you to sort of bring home what's required, okay? The board makes it easy for you, okay? Even if there is evidence of pretext, you still have to apply the first four prongs of the test. You don't get away with leaving that alone. You'd be making a mistake to not write about union activity, knowledge, some theory, whether it be combination or what have you. You know, it may be obvious on the facts, then again it may not, you know. But even in even if there's evidence of pretext, you do need both. I mean, you do need to do both parts of the analysis.
I have a question about Darlington weight related to Gissel, because in Darlington, the court said that 301 facility is close to it, even if it's before A, and having union reason the employee to close it. But with Gissel, it's that she can't rent it to close based on
union. Yeah, it's an interesting observation. I think what you get to there, and the reason for the difference, is that when the when the threat to close is made, okay, simply threatening to close the facility can chill union activities of employees who want to organize and who want a union. It can cause them to halt in their tracks and stop, right? Operating under the fear that if they go forward with their plan, the facility is going to close. In a different framework where the employer actually shuts down the facility, they believe, you know, as you mentioned, no evidence that it's to chill union activities elsewhere. That decision to completely shut it down and go out of business is so connected to core entrepreneurial rights to simply decide it's not worth it, I don't want to operate this way, that decision is going beyond simply chilling union activities. It's a fundamental decision to completely cease operations entirely. It's the reason that Darlington draws the line at shutting down where the objective is to chill union activities in the other facility. That they won't permit, okay? But where it's simply one facility, then, yeah, it looks like the two are kind of incongruous, but if you think about it, they're really not. The threat is merely a threat. It's not uttered with seriousness, okay? It's not said unless you can show the objective fact and that it's a reasonable prediction, right? Which is okay. But if it's said with an eye toward simply halting the union activity, that's threatening, restraining, or coercing in the meaning of 8A1. Going beyond that and simply shutting down entirely is within the employer's entrepreneurial right. And, you know, it's beyond simply sort of coercing anybody. That's the end. They're not going to be in business anymore. You know, that's into their operation. Yeah.
So then there's a difference between a small company and a large company in that context, then, right? Like in Darlington, it was a large company and one branch was shut down for the day after the purpose of chilling. But if, say, it was a 3-plant company and they shut down one, would it be different in that case? Then?
I don't know that the size of the company matters so much as the objective. In other words, let's say we have a company with 400 employees in New York and, you know, 800 employees down in Piscataway, right? The fact that they shut down the 400 employee facility, if it's the chill union activity in the 800 employee facility, it's bad on the Darlington. Take it out of that context. We have 4 employees in New York and 8 in Piscataway. Would it make a difference? Not really. It doesn't matter the size. What matters is the objective and whether there's evidence to show that the purpose of shutting down facility number 1 was to chill union activity at facility number 2. Now, if you only got one facility and you don't have 2, then you're not in Darlington at all, okay? If there's just one facility and the employer says, look, I don't want to have a union here. I can't do business with a union. I'd rather not do business at all and shut down a facility. The employer has always been permitted to do that. And Darlington said it, actually. They come right out pretty much say that, as she pointed out. Yeah?
You just said close one down for economic reasons to do that. Like you three facilities just close one down because you just can't keep all three open then.
Sure. Absolutely. Why not? I mean, the only thing that would come up is if there's already a bargaining obligation there, then you have this effects bargaining on the, you know.
Say there's like a little bit of evidence that might be an activity, just like the employees argue, like, all right, it's not just that, look at my folks. Obviously, employees are not.
Yeah, it's going to be a fact by fact, you know, case by case situation. You know, it's going to be assessed on all the evidence. No easy solution to that, you know. You know, sometimes there's evidence there, like in the sample question. Sometimes there's not, you know. So, that's it? I guess that's it. You know, it's funny, these cookies reminded me of a story. I guess I'll leave you with a story, since I told stories also. And this is it. My professor brought in Montebrook on the last day of class. To every class he taught, to his white baby. And it beat the Adam's cookies, believe me. I mean, it was much better. And I apologize, but my wife is working and taking care of two kids because he didn't have time to baby. But he occasionally brought in food during the semester. Unusual, sometimes not. He would bring in bagels and cream cheese. He brought in bagels and cream cheese one day. I don't know why I got out of bed, because I was suffering that day. I did not do that. But there I was, sitting in the class, getting through. And he brings in, on all days, he brings in bagels and cream cheese. And unlike me, who basically offered these to you out of the goodness of my heart, you don't want to eat them. I don't care. Don't eat them. It's all right with me. If he brought in food, you didn't not eat it. You had to eat it. That was, you were asking for trouble if you didn't eat it. Okay? And I knew I was asking for trouble on this day to not get up and eat it. But nevertheless, I wasn't in a position where I felt I could digest anything further. And, of course, he noticed immediately that I hadn't gotten up. Right? And he looked at me and said, "Eat." And I said, "I'd rather not." He said, "What do you mean you'd rather not? Eat!" Okay, now you got my attention. I'm going to have to figure out a way to eat this stuff, or else it's going to be torture. What am I going to do? Explain it enough. So I start to eat this stuff, and what a dreadful mistake. Of course, now I am compelled, in the middle of the class, to get up. The worst thing you can do, because that, of course, is going to inspire a "Where do you think you're going? You get up, you want to leave in the middle." Do I say anything? I don't say a word. I sit here, I go on about my business, right? What am I going to compel you to stay? This was a complete no-no. But what was I going to do? Right? And I was gone for quite some time. Needless to say, I paid for it for the next two classes. Taught me a lesson. But you know what? If anybody wants to finish the cookies. On that note, I will be reachable by email. So, you know, if you want to reach me by email, you can. I'll be here on Saturdays from 9:45 to 10:45 if you have any questions. The exam, as I mentioned before, is a limited open book exam. You can bring in your casebook. You can bring in your notes. You can bring in any outline you worked on. You can bring in outlines you worked on with other people. What you can't do is bring in commercially purchased outlines like Gilbert's. Don't bring in the developing label, or you can't go online. Things of that nature. Quite frankly, I gotta tell you that even if I permitted that, I would be doing you a horrid disservice, because I looked at some of those commercial outlines a while ago, and my goodness, I don't agree with the way in which they present this stuff. And if it gets presented that way on my exam, please, do it the way I want. All right? Do it the way it was explained. See, you don't run into the problem of having to say, "Well, Gilbert said it was this." I don't care what Gilbert had to say. I don't care what the developing label was. The developing label was an employer manifesto. Are you kidding me? What do I care what the developing label was told you? It's what I said. It's what's in the case. Good luck.
I have a question.
Oh, here you go.
You've gotten to three.
Yes.
The contract doesn't cover a term, right? You've got six, right?
You never bought it about
it. Never. Now we're moving our contract and doing something.
What's going to be important? Right, you never bought it about it. I want my safety to cover the following things. I want to have roads, wires, and need your first aid. I'm a first aid kid here, right? And I'll clean up the loose wire as far as practice. He said, "No, wait, I don't want it. I want the back gas. You will see the cost of any immediate first aid." I'm not going to. He's fighting over the region. Yeah! The region. The employer can unilaterally those things. Right? Here. you have your bargaining over a mandatory subject at a time where during a contractual term where you still have the obligation to do so because it's not automatic. And it was not discussed in the Undocumented workers are, well, it's funny you mentioned that. The issue is before the Supreme Court right now. Currently, undocumented workers are employees within the meaning of the Act. Okay? Section 2.3. Despite the fact that they are employees under the Act, enjoy the Act's protection. The remedies to which they are entitled are brought into question. Number one, under a case called Shorthand, decided by the Supreme Court, ordinarily an employee would be entitled to an offer of reinstatement if the employee is unlawfully terminated under the Act. These employees are only entitled to limited reinstatement pending their ability to show that they are lawful residents. Back pay is another situation that's come up in Hoffman Plastic Compounds where the undocumented employee engaged in fraudulent sort of misrepresentation. In other words, obtained a Social Security number and presented that to the employer, even though that was not her Social Security number, and fraudulently misrepresented that this was her. That employee under Hoffman would not be entitled to back pay. What has come up is whether or not, and it's an unsettled issue, the employee who would never ask and never produced a fraudulent document, but nevertheless was undocumented, is that employee entitled to back pay under the National Labor Relations Act? An administrative law judge concluded that that employee was entitled to back pay. The board has not ruled on that issue.
So undocumented is protected as an employer.
As employees, yes. The other issue that's come up is undocumented workers voted recently in an NLRB election in a case called Agriprocessors. The employer has challenged the certification the board issued, that quote-unquote that test of certification method I told you about, refused to bargain to induce the inability to practice charge. We talked all about that, right? And now, waiting for the Supreme Court to decide is whether or not the undocumented worker has quote-unquote representational rights to vote in an NLRB election and to have union representation. That's the active processes case before the court. So now, one could say that. It's an open issue. The board has taken the position that the employee is entitled to those protections, but that's from the
court. One thing you say, like, it's an unfair labor practice. The remedy is pretty much that they couldn't do that. So, like, if someone was fired, they'd probably get their job.
Well, it depends. You see, the discharge context, the employee is entitled to back pay and an offer of reinstatement, and the employer is obligated to post a notice saying that you won't do this kind of thing again, right? Take the unilateral change situation, and we'll go to surveillance and say, unilateral change situation where the employer has maybe done a unilateral change without reaching a good faith in the past, or did it under number one where they had no consent. In that situation, the remedy would be cease and desist from doing that and return to what it was, right? The status quo ante. Surveillance. The remedy would be limited to a notice posting saying, "We promise we won't do that again." Okay? They can't really, to the extent that there's a threat, it would also probably call for them to rescind the threat and say, "I take it back."
Right. Well, that's what my notice also says. This gets someone fired, they don't necessarily lose the status of employee.
Oh, right. And, yeah. Right, that comes up as the sort of the preliminary discussion into the definition of an employee. An employee of the employer is terminated, right? Believe it or not, at one point early on, and some bright-eyed employer tried to argue that, well, we fired her. She's not an employee anymore, so she doesn't have the act protections. That would be ridiculous. What would the point be? Of course, the employee retains her employee status as an employee, despite the fact that she is no longer employed by the employer. How else could she obtain redress under the National Labor Relations Act?
All
right. Right, that's all that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Do you hear Saturday?
Saturday, 9:45 till about 10:45.
Random emails, possibly. So.
You can email me anytime.
I put questions out there, go on my outline.
Sure, you can.
I'm still working on it. There's questions.
You can email me anytime.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
And take care. Thank you.
Okay, so the first thing is she wrote it on her memoir, she was supposed to write it. What exactly did she have the problems with the man? Not about upstairs, but upstairs. Did she exactly give her a sign? What was her problem? Did she not know how to do it? Okay, so did she draw the wrong boxes? Did she not understand how to get the number? Was there any confusion about the weather? Because I need to know if she needs extra help in the man. We don't have to put this in English. I need to know if she needs extra help in her man or she doesn't.